The following program is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. Support for the distribution of this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR Arts and Performance Fund. Contributors include the National Endowment for the Arts, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and Bell Atlantic. The Nature of Music series is produced by Garuda Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Garuda Productions, The Nature of Music.
One of Bach's sons, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, said, if you want to move your audience, if you want them to feel something, don't sit like a stick in front of your harpsichord, but move and express the music with your body, with the way you look to the audience.
I'm Lynn Farmer. This time on The Nature of Music, the topic is music and the body. As C.P.E. Bach observed two centuries ago, we make music through our bodies, and we respond to music with our bodies. So we're asking questions on this program about how our breath, our heartbeat, our fingers and hands and feet affect the music we make, how our bodies feel music, and how the body can make music without instruments, and especially what's so special about the human voice. Violinist Yehudi Menuhin talks about the importance of your feet in playing the violin. Jazz singer Betty Carter tells us how she uses parts of her body to overcome noise in the places where she sings. And John D. and Friz from North Carolina demonstrate the art of patting and tapping using just their bodies. But first, did you ever notice how an infant, when it hears some music it likes, begins to bounce around, keeping time? Music historian Leonard Myers says C.P.E. Bach was right on track. You can find a fundamental truth about music by observing the way our bodies react to it.
People move to sound, and that movement is a very important part of one's experience of music, no matter which music you're talking about. I don't care if you're talking about Mozart or rock and roll, and part of your response and understanding of music, I think, is very much a matter of your total body and mind. In fact, the body and mind are one, not two. It's why conductors and the movements of conductors mean a lot to audiences, why the movements of performers mean a lot to audiences.
Jazz singer Betty Carter can't improvise without using body language to help express her musical thoughts. One reason, she says, is noise. She needs to use everything she's got to overcome the noise in the places where she works. Customers talking, a cash register, a telephone.
I don't think I could improvise and do the things that I do without moving my body. Everybody uses their hands. Even the classical people use their hands. They know it's expressive. Even when you're talking, you know, it's always the hands are very, very important. It says something to people.
And it's not just her hands. Carter says she's got to use everything available to get the message across.
Well, you can't move your body unless you move your hips and your knees and your feet and your shoulders and the whole bit. Your body is the whole thing. It encompasses all of that. So if you're moving your body, you're moving everything. So therefore, yes, hips, knees, thighs, breast, hair, eyes, whatever is moving.
It steals across my pillow as soft as a willow the wind. And in his song there is sadness because there's no you.
Jazz singer Betty Carter. Maybe that's what we mean when we say it was a moving performance. Educator Frederick Erickson says there's a kind of body music that we use when we talk. I nod my head exactly at the right moment as you tell me what happened yesterday in traffic court. Musicians integrate precisely timed body language into ensemble playing, says Erickson. So do people in the audience.
If you watch in an orchestra concert, those page turns aren't random. And they're not just that they get to the end of the page. It's that the page gets turned in a moment of the music. And you'll see people in the audience reach up and scratch their head in a moment in the music. I mean, that capacity to enter into ensemble, and that's just like what three guitarists do when they're playing together and cueing each other with the way the neck comes around on a certain beat or the way somebody's leaning into a note.
Erickson thinks that music is a kinesthetic experience, that it's a special kind of social interaction that involves sound expressed in movement, and that the growing fetus in the mother's womb learns this language of movement and sound when the mother speaks.
The fetus hears these stressed syllables as the sound comes through the amniotic fluid and the various tissues surrounding the uterus. But when it reaches the baby's ears, it reaches the baby's ears in the form of pops and clicks, percussive sounds. But if these are happening more often than not at a regular interval, and also the mother's body is moving in time with that, the kid gets kinesthetic information about where we are in time now, and also auditory. So it's conceivable that people are getting experience in their own cultural group's speech and interaction rhythms even before birth, but certainly right after birth.
French ethnomusicologist Gilbert Rouget.
La musique est le pro est un produit.
Music is purely and uniquely a product of the body. Voice is a technique to use your breathing and your vocal cords. All instrumental music is the result of body and muscular actions which are coordinated. A good musician is someone who knows how to use extremely well his body, his fingers, his motor coordination, and a good singer, even more.
It's more than just taking care of the voice, it's taking care of the whole body.
Singer Phyllis Brynjulfsson.
Because everything in the breath capacity is involved all the way down below the waist. That much of the human body is involved. And then if we can go further, we can say, well, really the knees are involved and certainly the support of the legs, how you stand. If you have a injured toe, it will show up in the voice.
The voice is so sensitive to the body it's in, says Brynjulfsson, that you can sometimes hear in the voice the body's pulse.
The heartbeat can be very much heard and felt in the just in a singing of a phrase or a singing of a soft tone, for example. If I'm trying to control a tone in a very soft manner, I can hear a certain throb. Dum, dum, dum. That beat will come through, even with the vibrato.
Thank you. And if you're a young singer, says Brynjolfsson, you'll find out just how important the body is when you see how a real professional singer breathes.
I think it's when they finally get onto a major stage next to a major opera singer, and they discover that that opera singer breathes all the way down to the back of her heels and that she can shove aside the entire group on stage to do that. I think that's when a young person realizes, oh my gosh, I've got to work on this.
Brynjolfsson tells her students how to work on this.
Well, for example, you put your hands together in the front of your body and take a long, deep breath and let it out like so, from the lower abdomen, and you count up to 30 to do that. And then you expand on that by going to 40. Then you get louder. You do it really loud. Never, ever pushing down from the top of the chest, because you don't want to push on the lungs from that area. You want it to be from the abdomen.
So all this breathing practice pays off when you finally become an internationally known singer, right? Well, Phyllis Brynjolfsson was waiting in the wings to sing recently at an important concert. She looked out on stage and saw that she had to hike about 60 yards just to get to her place in front of the orchestra. Looking at the audience, she suddenly had an anxiety attack.
Here I've done all this breathing for 10 years, and I see my mother sitting out there in the 15th row, and my breathing becomes high, totally strangling my throat. So after finding my place 60 feet later, I'm standing there going, and the conductor starts without me getting control of my heartbeat or the breath. And there I am. Suddenly, I have to call upon any experience in my life that has told me how to get control immediately. There's no fooling around. Here I am, and this is a big fee, and there's a lot of people that pay a lot of money to hear this. It's not time for me to have a heart attack. So you call upon your experience, and one of the best things to do for control at that moment when you have terrific shakes is to suck on a straw. Then you hopefully can begin to relax a little and enjoy the performance.
Singer Phyllis Brynjolfsson. This is The Nature of Music, and we're talking about music and the body. I have in my hand here a book by violinist Yehudi Menuhin. It's called The Complete Violinist, and there's a lot of advice for the young fiddler in here about how to train the body. I think my favorite exercise is right here on page 17. It's this one. It's an exercise for the toes. There's a picture here of Mr. Menuhin spreading his toes apart and stretching them in every conceivable direction. And there are also some instructions over here on page 23 on breathing, wherein he suggests one breathes against the resistance of your spine. That is to say, imagine the breath you take as a balloon filling your lungs, stomach, abdomen, and pushing against your spine.
The other day I met an excellent young violinist, the French violinist, Oleg Raphael, who just won first prize in Moscow. And he was telling me that one of his greatest teachers when he learnt almost more than any other time was listening to Elisabeth Schwarzkopf give classes in singing, that he learned the application of breathing and phrasing to the violin. This is something quite important. The breathing of the player is almost as important in violin playing as it is in singing. And to a certain extent, the bow is the breath.
In his book, The Complete Violinist, Yehudi Menuhin stresses physical conditioning, not just of the bowing arm, but the entire body. He gives a lot of emphasis to the importance of sport and concentrates heavily on yoga exercises. Mr. Menuhin says the physical element is crucial in violin playing.
The body has to attune itself to the violin as much as the violin to the body that's playing. And I think it's very beneficial so long as people remember not to try to grab it or hold it as if it were an axe, you know, or the best golfers know how to handle their stick with flexibility. And I think the violinist can learn a great deal from other sports and from acrobats and, of course, runners and all those who have to discipline and tame their body to specific ends. Feet are terribly important as well. The balance of the body is secured on our arch and the five toes. And if a person is, say, flat-footed and haven't had opportunity to exercise, to strengthen, to make their feet pliable, and if they have stood great hours like policemen, nurses, and violinists do, and have not taken their rest and try to put their feet up, that tends to create flat feet, which does not help the violinist. The violinist can feel much freer when they can swing on their feet and when the toes are alive and respond, shall we say, to pressures.
If you should just happen to be passing by a certain black neighborhood in Durham, North Carolina, of a Saturday evening, you might hear something like this. John D. Holman and Quentin Holloway, most people just call them John D. and Friz, make music without instruments or voices, just their bodies.
People don't have much to look forward to as far as entertainment concerned. They used to have wood choppings, corn chuckings, and things like that. And the people in the neighborhood would always compete. Some guys could do the chossle, some could do the buck dance, some could blow a harmonica, some could play guitar. And when you're impressed, you just go back and work on what you like and what you try to do, and that was a competition you had. That was a form of recreation, too. That's the kind of recreation you had.
That's Friz, the one that does the buck dancing this time. They usually trade off, but right now, John D. is doing the patting.
So I more or less use both my leg and my chest, which goes something like this. I keep my left hand on my left leg at all times, and I work my right one from my left, right leg to my chest. So this is the sound you get. And all chest like this hall we were talking about. That's all in the beat. you got your same pat, but you can speed it up.
Most all the working men, they wore what you call it. You used to call them brogues.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's brogue what
shoes.
They used to call brogues.
They used to make these little brogue shoes. They designed some tap shoes. They had a piece of steel go all around the heel and across the toe. And that was a work shoe. You remember that, don't you? Mm-hmm. Call them brogue. And so when people would get those shoes that could tap that hole, they could make them sound. Nine times out of ten, most of it's playing shoes.
John D. Holman and Quentin Holloway, tapping and patting in North Carolina. In certain Pacific islands, you clap your hands to emphasize certain words when you're singing, and you have different techniques for different words. Anthropologist Adrian Kepler.
In Polynesia, in Tonga and Samoa, for example, there are two kinds of clapping your hands, and they have different names. So, for example, in Tongan, if you strike your hands together flat, it's called pasi and sounds like this. Whereas if you strike your hands together in a cupped fashion, like this, that's called fu. So you have pasi and fu. Pasi and fu. And, for example, when you are singing and you use certain words that would be elaborated by striking your hands together in different ways, such as the word Tatakamotonga, which is the name of a village, you might say Tatakamotonga to elaborate the sounds of the poetry as you are performing them.
Clapping and poetry of the Tongan people of Polynesia. This is The Nature of Music, and we're talking about music and the body. Later in this program, we'll hear how an orchestra without a conductor keeps together by breathing together. But first, Canadian composer and philosopher R. Murray Schafer says breathing is a rhythm of the human organism. The phraseology of music is entirely governed by breathing.
So that even when you take an instrument that doesn't necessarily have to breathe, say a violin or an organ or something of that sort, the composers tended always to phrase the music as if the music were breathing, as if the organ were breathing. In the choral preludes of Bach, we have the feeling that the organ is actually breathing when in fact it doesn't have to. So that very rarely up until the 20th century do we have music that doesn't breathe. Electronic music was probably the first kind of music that doesn't breathe, and maybe the reason that so many people originally found it so eerie was simply that fact, that it wasn't phrased the way music up to that time had been phrased.
There's an ancient kind of orchestral music in which there is no conductor, and the ensemble keeps together by a collective sense of breathing. It's the Japanese court music called gangaku.
Gangaku, the time is not based on a 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. It is based on something more like if I were to sing a very short part of a very famous piece, Etennaku, is Tora Ro. Pause is a breath pause. It's when everybody must breathe together, or at least the wind players, because there are string players too. But the string players have to adjust to the wind players, and the time kind of expands and contracts. As a human being breathes, as you're talking, you have to take a breath. But as a Western musician would take a very quick breath to stay within the metronomic rhythm, the Japanese allow for that breath time, and that is the ma. That is the space. Court Music from Japan, Gangaku. If you'd like a free program guide to the Nature of Music series or information on how to order a cassette or a transcript of this program on Music and the Body, write to The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Here's that address again. The Nature of Music, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Thanks to NPR member stations WJHU in Baltimore and WETA in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Carl Stone. Our program on Music and the Body is written and produced for Garuda Productions by Carl Signell and Deborah Jane Lamberton. John Widoff is the mix engineer. The executive producer for the series is Dr. Carl Signell. This series is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting through NPR's Satellite Program Development Fund. And on this program, the final word about music and the body comes from a sect of musical mystics from Bengal, India. They call themselves the Bauls. They believe that all wisdom comes from the body.
Akash Batash Ogni Jol Mati.
The air and the wind and the sun and the energy and the spirit.
Shob kichui ei deho age khujte hobe tar pore shob kichu paoa jabe.
We can find answers to everything, but we have to search our body first.
Tar mane ei dehotei shob kichu ache.
Which means the answers lie in our body.
I'm Lynn Farmer. This is NPR, National Public Radio.